It's the Jefferson Exchange here on Jefferson Public Radio. I'm John Baxter in today for Jeffrey Riley. In this hour, Steve Almond was a guy who was in love with football. But after a while, he started realizing that the relationship was not very comfortable anymore. As much as he loves the game, or did, Steve Almond felt he had to leave it behind. And he tells the story in his book, Against Football. We talked to him as football season was just starting in 2014. And we thought we'd re-air this broadcast as football season is getting ready to start in 2017. You'll hear the interview in its entirety, hosted by Jeffrey Riley, right after this weather forecast with Colleen Pike. Good morning, Colleen.
Good morning, John. It looks like we still have smoke lingering in the valleys throughout the listening area. In the Cascades and Siskiyous today, patchy smoke with sunshine, highs near 83. Clear overnight, lows around 49. Tomorrow, and in Wairika, actually, patchy smoke today, sunny and hot, highs near 102. Patchy smoke and clear tonight, lows around 60. Weeta, Mount Shasta, sunny today, highs near 95. Clear tonight, lows around 56. Redding and Red Bluff, the hot spot today, sunshine, hot, highs near 109. Clear tonight, lows around 73. In the Klamath Basin, patchy smoke with sunshine tonight, highs near 91. Clear tonight, lows around 53. The Southern Oregon coast, sunshine today, highs at 71. Lows tonight around 54 with increasing clouds. The Northern California coast, also patchy smoke and morning fog today, then partly sunny, highs near 61. Cloudy tonight with lows around 54. In Roseburg and the Umpqua Basin, patchy smoke, sunshine today, highs near 91, clear tonight, lows around 58. In the Rogue Valley, sunny and hot today, highs near 100, clear tonight, lows around 62. And in Eugene, Springfield today, sunshine, highs near 83, increasing clouds tonight, lows around 57.
Thanks, Colleen. We have some traffic information for Friday morning. There's been a wildfire between Grants Pass and Rogue River, and it's near I-5. The delay right now is about 20 minutes. There is a wildfire in that area. The northbound shoulder of I-5 is closed, just the shoulder. There is heavy traffic in the area, though, and a short delay, so be careful if you're driving on I-5 between Rogue River and Grants Pass. Also, Oregon 138, 32 miles west of the intersection of North Umpqua Highway, is closed because of the wildfire there, the North Umpqua complex. And there is a fire now burning up in the Sisters area. So if you're going to be traveling up in that direction for the eclipse, be aware that as of today, Oregon 242, 1 mile east of the intersection with the McKenzie Highway, Oregon 126 is closed between there and Sisters. So that's the latest of the road closures that we know about in the morning hours on Friday. Our topic this hour on the Exchange is football, the American kind of football. It is revered by millions and reviled by, well, fewer people anyway. The interview you'll hear this morning is with someone who really feels both ways. He had a real love-hate relationship with football. Steve Almond was his name. Here's Jeffrey Riley with an interview with Steve Almond we did from the late summer of 2014.
Weekends in America change greatly between August and September because starting in September, weekends feature football. Peewee games, high schools, colleges, and the NFL. Millions of people strap on helmets and pads and crash into fellow players all autumn long. We love the game. We watch it far more than any other sport. But we have to look past the toll it takes on its players. Today's guest can no longer look past that toll. Steve Almond still describes himself as a fan, specifically an Oakland Raiders fan, but his latest book is called Against Football, one fan's reluctant manifesto. Steve Almond has worn several hats in his career: journalist, sports reporter, play-by-play guy, and author of both fiction and nonfiction, short and long. He frequently writes commentary and journalism pieces for the New York Times Magazine. Steve, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be with you, Jeffrey.
Let us say up front, this is an excellent time to be talking about the NFL. The Ray Rice episode seems to be everywhere this week. When it's on NPR even, you know everybody's talking about Ray Rice and the NFL.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, I think they're talking a lot about Ray Rice, and they're talking about, this is what the media tends to do. They focus on sort of a scandal and a convenient scapegoat or set of scapegoats. And in fact, I think what's happening underneath that, honestly, is that people are recognizing that we're kind of at a moral crossroads when it comes to football, that the game is certainly the most, for me, I personally feel it's the most stirring spectacle, athletic spectacle that we have, unbelievably compelling to watch, combines dense strategy with these primal moments of grace and athleticism. It's thrilling, suspenseful. It's unassailably pleasurable to watch. But it also has all these moral corruptions that I think people, because we're Americans, tend to look past. We're not real good as a culture at morally interrogating our pleasures. You know, we want to eat the bacon, but we don't want to see the slaughterhouse. And this is, I think, what's starting to happen is that there are enough stories coming out, and you really could wait another week or two, and there would be another story about an athlete who's arrested or some greedy owner, you know, grabbing taxpayer money in some community that could use that money in a lot better ways, a lot more humane ways. I mean, there's no shortage of stories or occasions in which people are going to question the morality of this whole enterprise, because football is a beautiful game, but it's also at this point a billion-dollar industry. I think that all of these things together are leading both fans and non-fans to start to really confront the dark side of the sport. And I say that with no great joy. I am heartbroken. Really, the book comes out of a place of being really heartbroken that this beautiful game that so perfectly reconnects us to the intuitive pleasures of childhood is also such a vehicle for really awful views and practices. You know, racist, I argue, racist, misogynist, homophobic, militaristic, and against empathy and really all about violence and domination. That's what football is, if I'm honest with myself, and that's part of why I'm drawn to it. But it's also ultimately part of why I had to walk away from it.
So the physical violence and domination aside, I mean, some of the strains you talk about, the homophobia, the misogyny, these are and certainly the use of money can be applied to just about any professional sport, can't it?
Yep, absolutely. I wasn't writing about other sports, though. I'm writing about football, which is five times bigger than and more popular and profitable than any other sport. So the scale is different, Jeffrey. In other words, if you have a place like, let's take Houston, just as an example. I could also take Indianapolis or Baltimore or St. Louis or Detroit. You know, in Houston, they lost one team because, of course, the NFL is a cartel, and they are a legal monopoly, and they play a game called franchise free agency, where they basically are constantly threatening cities to leave and go to another city, and the politicians are terrified because the fans are so attached to the game that they know they can't let them go. And so they're able to essentially extort, or we could say apply leverage, and get millions, hundreds of millions of dollars in taxpayer money that pays for stadiums that billionaires could pay for. Every NFL owner is a billionaire, or at least almost everyone, and many of them are multi-billionaires. They could pay for these stadiums, and since they derive almost all of the profits from those stadiums, they should pay for them. But the public gets public money gets siphoned. In Houston, it was, I believe, $250 million in taxpayer money that could be used in other ways. And I know there's the argument that's made, well, it encourages economic it stimulates the economy and so forth. But sports economists have looked at all this stuff, and it is not true. The NFL is a circus. It is not a way that the most economically vulnerable communities create real opportunity. That, as we all know, is done through the boring work of educating students, keeping the streets safe, investing in businesses that supply good jobs year-round. And that's not what football is. It's a carnival.
Well, and you give an example in this particular realm about Art Modell when he moved the Cleveland Browns to Baltimore and they became the Ravens. I mean, the amounts of money that he made over the course of his ownership are just ungodly.
Well, so he, and it's a brilliant example, because not just because he broke all the Cleveland Browns fans' hearts, but he got a deal, and that's what any businessman is going to do. People always say, well, the NFL will improve, you know, they'll figure out these safety issues, which is nonsense, or they'll become more humane. They're a corporation. They have a cash register where their conscience should be. They're not going to improve until we, the fans, force them to by, in some cases, just turning away from the game. It's really a naive and beautiful idea, but it's ultimately false that the game is going to change because the good-hearted people in the NFL are going to make it change.
And Steve Ullman joined us in September 2014 to talk about his book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. More of that interview when we return to the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange, I'm Colleen Pike. Steve Ullman is a former sports reporter for newspapers in Texas and Florida and a lover of football in its purest form, which does not exist. He wrote a book decrying the violence and domination and misogyny and economic piracy he finds in football now, especially in the NFL. The book is called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve Ullman visited in September of 2014 and took some calls from listeners, but since this show is pre-recorded, we can't take any new calls or emails today.
You use a quote from Kevin Falk, formerly of the New England Patriots, as the title of your preface. What was it he said?
He says, I was out, but I... he says, well, the title of the preface, so the episode is one in which he got knocked unconscious. He suffered a concussion. And the preface itself, I'm just trying to get the exact phrase here to make sure I get it right.
Wasn't I was out, but I wasn't out cold?
I wasn't out cold, but I was out. That's right, right. So, I mean, he literally just is suffering a concussion and almost linguistically trying to explain what has happened to him, though he can't quite because he has a concussion.
And this is something you clipped out of a newspaper and posted someplace?
Right. I mean, I basically thought this was, I put it over my desk. And like anything that you put up, like I had this initial view of it, which is, oh, well, this is, I thought it was funny. It was, it said something elemental about athletic delusion, that the pitiful way that players hide from the truth of what they do, right, that they earn ungodly sums of money and acclaim for demolishing each other. And what I was doing was assuming a posture of ironic distance. Is what Americans do. We do that to avoid the corruption of our spiritual arrangement. It allows us ironic distance to separate ourselves from, like, these big, complicated moral systems around us, whether it's political or religious or familial. We get to sit in judgment of other people rather than ourselves. But here's the thing. The reason I cut out that clipping is because I myself was out of it. I was morally concussed because I was able to watch this game without recognizing that I was really consuming as entertainment, a spectacle in which real people like Kevin Falk were really getting their brains traumatized. And the reason I believe I sort of came to that finally was that I saw my beloved mother descend into an acute dementia. It was just after my third kid was born. I flew out to California and, walked into the ICU, and she was gone. And this is one of the smartest women I know, and she was literally overnight, did not know where she was, who she was, didn't even recognize me all the time. You cannot come face-to-face with that and have it suddenly be a real thing without recognizing that that is what's happening to football players later in their lives. And, you know, we were talking before the break, Jeffrey, part of the thing about football is that even if you're not a fan, it matters that Art Modell, you know, moved to Baltimore and got $200 million in taxpayer money and got to play rent-free in his stadium for 30 years. It matters that we took money from the public till and siphoned it into a billionaire's pocket. And that's not something that's my view. Those are the facts. His franchise was valued at $163 million before he left Cleveland, and it's now worth more than $600 million. These are not, the book is really built on medical and legal facts, along with some of my ideas about what I think the game does to us morally and spiritually. But nothing in the book is made up. I don't have to make it up. The dark side of football, what it really represents, is right there, in front of us. The question is whether we're going to look at it or not, because we love the game so much. And once you look at it, it's very hard to go back to sitting on your couch going, go get him, go concuss that guy, go contribute to his dementia later in life.
Steve Almond is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. It includes what you call the brief and wildly subjective history of football. The way you describe it, was there even a ball at first?
Yeah, well, so it basically started as a series of controlled riots. It was a hazing ritual, which I think is actually probably pretty telling. Initially, there was a ball, but there's basically a pretext for college sophomores to beat up college freshmen, and it evolved from this sort of folk game taking elements of rugby and soccer into a more organized spectacle. And very quickly, it was always so brutal that there were questions about whether it should exist. In 1904, 18 players died, most of them prep school boys, and a whole bunch more suffered gruesome injuries, you know, wrenched spinal cords, fractured skulls, that kind of thing. An editorialist literally said, we got to get rid of this, and lots of colleges did actually stop playing football, and Theodore Roosevelt, who was a football player and his son was a football player, said, wait a second, we need to, quote, minimize the danger, though not so much that the game would be played, quote, on too ladylike a basis.
Ladylike, I love that, yeah.
Yeah, well, those are the values. I mean, people talk a lot about Ray Rice and, you know, oh, well, he's just so terrible what he's done, and it's so terrible. Roger Goodell should have punished him for knocking out his girlfriend. And the truth of the matter is that if you take a step back, the values of the game are not the values of 2014 when it comes to gender. They're not the values of 1950. They're not even the values of 1850. They're the values of 1550. Guinevere's in a halter top, and Lancelot is in shoulder pads. Those are the gender values. When you watch a game, when you consume a game and subsidize a game that selects for players who use their aggression and violence to be effective in the world, that is powerful. We are consuming their savagery. That's what those parabolic mics on the sidelines are there for, to pick up on every bone-crunching decibel of the big hits. That's why we watch those replays over and over and over again of all the big hits, or why the crowd goes, ooh, when there's an especially violent collision. That is us consuming that violence, and those young men are learning that that's how they're effective in the world. We expect them to then step off of the field and suddenly be gentlemen role models. The other message that football is sending is that women are sexual ornaments who are supposed to jiggle on the sidelines. I'm not making that up. That's not my speculation. That is what I see on my TV, and if I allowed my daughter to watch, that's what she would see.
When you describe us as consumers of this, you don't say so specifically in the book, but it sounds to my ears at this moment that it's on a moral par with buying drugs and thinking, well, this doesn't hurt anybody, when the drugs are coming from some cartel that does God knows what to get those drugs into your hands.
Well, I would say it like this, that I, for years, Jeffrey, carried around a suitcase full of excuses and rationalizations, like every other fan of any athletic endeavor, but especially of football. And in that suitcase were all my excuses to make myself feel okay about watching, as you know, consuming as a form of entertainment something that basically was brutal enough to cause brain damage. And what the first thing I said was, they're adults. They get paid a lot of money. There's a lot of dangerous jobs out there. Hey, this is America. If they want to incur the risks, they know the risks, and let them. That's not the moral equation that my book is interested in. I understand exactly why a football player chooses to play football, even knowing that there are risks. I get that exactly. That's how they've been defined. That's their entire sense of self. Of course they're going to decide to do that, and they are free to do that. The question is, the moral equation that I was interested in is, why do we watch? And because, after all, that job that he has being a football player and that huge salary comes directly from the fans. You know, the sports media is always trying to subtract the fans' responsibility out of the equation. They're always saying, oh, it's Ray Rice's fault, it's Roger Goodell's fault, it's this greedy owner, it's that greedy owner. The truth is, we built football. We built the entire football industrial complex from the peewee level on up to the, you know, multi-billion dollar NFL. Without us, it doesn't exist. And the truth of the matter is that if you really want to try to justify that, then you need to really look at what the game is in toto. You can't just choose the parts that feel convenient. That's that posture of ironic distance that I was talking about. You have to judge yourself rather than judging the game, its officials, its players, and so forth.
Steve Almond is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book is Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. He speaks poetically about the attractions of the game and very honestly about the things that make the game horrible to some of the people who play it, for sure, and to some of the other people connected to it as well. Here's Derek in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Almond.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I just have a couple thoughts I'd love your feedback on, Steve.
Sure.
I think that I have heard, I'm certainly not familiar with the study, that studies have been done that have shown that soccer actually causes more concussions than football, just as a comparison, mm-hmm. because of all the headers in particular, and then, of course, all the head-to-head contact. And then I also can't help but note that basketball has women on the sideline dancing.
Sure.
So I'm sure you've been asked that before. I'd like you to address that. And
sure.
then, while I don't share your intrinsic outrage at the sport, or at least it's much lower down the totem pole for me for things to be outraged by, I do. What outrages me is the power that the commissioner has, and I find this recent issue where he is leveraging drug suspensions for marijuana and amphetamine in particular for Wes Welker. To leverage the HGH testing in the sport, which I actually think would be a good thing. I just think it's interesting that the judge, jury, executioner guy can use the threat of punishment to leverage it. And so any of those, I'd just be curious to
sure.
get your feedback.
Right. Thanks, Derek.
So, yeah, those are all good points. Soccer, there is concussions there. The NFL commissioned a study that determined that recently retired pros ages 30 to 49 are 19 times more likely to suffer from brain trauma-related illnesses than non-players.
Now, that's 19 times, not 19% higher, yeah.
No, 19 times, okay. And because football players tend to underreport because they're tough guys who don't want to be seen as weak and so forth, we can assume that the number of concussions that they're receiving and the amount of difficulty they might have cognitively, they're probably masking, okay? So it's probably more than that. But I'm not really interested in saying, I mean, I think the other thing that people try to do is say, but everything's immoral and corrupt, so let us watch football. I'm not talking about everything else. I'm not interested in doing a comparison of relative morality. I'm talking about, as a heartbroken football fan, finally having to face after 40 years what the sport really is. And it is not just dangerous because of big catastrophic hits, it's dangerous because of the subconcussive hits that basically the small car accidents that happen inside players' helmets 1,000 or 1,500 times a season.
Now, in fact, there are studies that show that repeated low-level hits are just as bad, if not worse, than one big one, right?
Correct. For instance, and it's not just at the pro level. Like, we only see the 1% of the 1% of football players, the guys at the big colleges or at the pro level. Those are guys we're watching on TV. But one out of every 500 high school seniors who plays football is going to make the pros. And he's only going to make the pros probably for 4 years. He's not a star even. That's the reality. The other 499 never become famous enough that we're concerned about what their health issues are years down the line. And the truth is, for instance, Purdue University, they did this study that to me was terrifying, and it was of high school football. They wanted to see what's the effect of concussions on high school athletes. They're younger, their brains are less developed, their skeletal systems are less developed. So they put sensors inside the helmets of a couple of dozen players, and they had a control group of kids who'd never gotten concussions and the kids who had gotten concussions. The problem is, Jeffrey, that the kids in the control group who had never received a concussion, just hundreds of subconcussive hits, showed diminished brain function as the year went along. And not only that, by the end of the season, they were showing, some of them, no function in one of their frontal lobes. Now, you need to take a big step back morally and in a cultural sense and say, what would happen if there was a gas leak in the cafeteria at the local high school in your community and it was causing diminished brain function in high school students? There would be a panic the likes of which you cannot even imagine. It would be on the national news. That school would be shut down. The students would be quarantined. State attorney and federal officials would be in there. Law enforcement, the media would descend. Lawyers would descend. because something as horrible as diminished brain function was being wrought upon high school students who we're trying to educate. But when it's in the context of football, we put it on a field on Friday night, we light up that field, we sell popcorn, and we have cheerleaders cheering for the game. Our cultural priorities are really out of whack, and you can point to the whole athletic industrial complex. Derek's absolutely right, but the truth of the matter is it's more exaggerated in football because football is played and watched by far more Americans than any other game.
All right, let's take another call here. We're talking to Steve Almond about his book, Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. And here is Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Good morning. Considering that all the things that you've listed being perfectly obvious and public, what's the likelihood that the owners don't manipulate the games through the referees to have the outcomes that they desire?
Well, I would say that I'm not actually super concerned about that question because it would take me being really invested in what team wins. And I get that that's profoundly important to fans, and I get that that was profoundly important to me. I wanted my Raiders to win, and they were, at least for the last few years, constantly losing. And I think your question's really getting at gambling and all the money that is mixed up in football. And that's, again, true of every sport, but especially true of football. I don't know the likelihood, and I am not even interested in that question, because once you get at the question of gambling, that's its own moral quagmire. And this book is really concerned with what is football in and of itself? What values does it put across to us? What effect does it have on our communities? And what effect does it have on the health of the people who play it? Those are the issues I'm trying to take up.
Could there be additional incentives, though? Because he's talking about gambling incentives, but then we have to remember the bounty system that the New Orleans Saints put in place for injuring key players of other teams, and that cost the coach a year.
Of course, but the truth is, Jeffrey, every single defensive coach in the National Football League, if he's still working, is saying to his players explicitly or implicitly, knock the other guy out so he doesn't come back. I mean, football is a version of our capitalist ethos writ large. It's a winner-take-all system. And your job, especially in football, if the difference between a great player and a player who's never going to make it off the practice squad has to do with how much they can summon their aggression and violence and be effective knocking somebody's block off. If you are really good, if you can really muster that aggression and you can really control it and channel it and get to the quarterback and level them, you're going to make $18 million a year. And if you can't do that quite as well, you're going to be a nobody, a guy who played in college who never went anywhere, who has bad knees at age 25. I mean, that's how brutal the sport is. And that's part of the reason that I found the fan dynamic to be so ultimately kind of despicable to me, because I was like, look, these guys are under so much pressure all the time. That's the reason they're going back into games injured. That's the reason that they're so desperate to get good that they're taking drugs or bulking their bodies up to unnatural degrees. They're working out year round. They're under incredible pressure. Most of them have come from economically vulnerable neighborhoods, so they've got a lot of people who are relying on them to be a big star and to make it. And that kind of pressure really crushes them. I don't blame, and you can read any memoir of any player who's made it to the NFL, and you'll basically hear the same thing. They're injured all the time. Their lives are incredibly stressful. They're judged at their workplace by 50,000 screaming fans and a whole chorus of nasty sports reporters. They literally succeed or fail under the spotlight in a way that is so much more public and devastating than any of us. And some of them succeed, but far more people lose and do not succeed and never make it to the pros. And we only see that tiny percentage. It's like what we watch on TV. We only see the rich people. We only see the beautiful people. We only see the healthy people.
Yeah, we don't see the busted down ones who didn't make it. And you mentioned 4 years. That is actually the average length of stay in the NFL, isn't it?
Right. So, again, when people have this idea of, hey, these football players, they've got it made. They're just playing at celebrity golf tournaments and eating, you know, buffet breakfasts. It's like, wait a second. You're only seeing the guys who made it. We really, in this culture, don't want to look at everybody else. And that's not just the players, but the kids who never make it.
and more on the book Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto, as the Jefferson Exchange continues. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Colleen Pike. The writer Steve Allman loves the game of football but hates what it does to the individuals who play it and the society that abides it. He wrote a book called Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. There's our phone calls in this original airing, but it was 3 years ago, so we can't take any new calls or emails today. Here's Jeffrey Riley.
Here's Ryan and Eugene. Welcome to the Exchange with Steve Allman.
Well, great discussion, Steve, and I really want to commiserate. As every year, I am so torn.
Yeah.
Part of me that is incredibly excited about the return of football and fall and all of that it means, and yet, you know, when I was working in a local high school, and there was a banner above the coach's door that said "Blood makes the grass grow," and when my young son was playing junior varsity football, he came in one night. He says, "I'm football." I said, "Well, what's up?" He says, "You know, I said I want you to be involved in the sport." He said, "I'm sick of being yelled at." And so, you know, I'm. It's always been there. It's been there since my childhood. That this ethos, this sense of ethics of this is what creates leaders. This is what creates business leaders. These are the attributes that are going to make the strong entrepreneurial person that's going to drive the economy is what they learned on the football field. And
right.
I've been in many, many offices where, the backdrop of the office behind the desk is a variety of, you know, collegiate football in most cases. And so here's my dilemma. I agree that the ethos of the business capitalist community and everything we hate about the world is exemplified in football. So if we could change it, we could change football, could we actually simultaneously rethink things like, in income inequities and tax structures and Koch brothers and all the rest of the things that are? So that's my hope. That's my dream. I want to save my football, but I want it to become something that's honestly elegant and graceful and ethical.
Fix football, fix society. Ryan, thanks for that. Appreciate it. Steve, your thoughts?
Well, I think Ryan is like the guy who I hope will find this book, because I struggle with the same thing. Part of what I was realizing is here I am, this guy who has, you know, views that are very much around how can we enforce economic justice in this country? How can we have equality of opportunity, especially in our economically vulnerable communities? You know, I have all these values. How can we treat all people, no matter what their gender, orientation, class, race? How do we get to that, make America a more perfect union? I'm really an idealist about that. I believe we are the greatest country on earth. If we'd enact our values that we state so loudly, we'd be even better. And I, at the same time, found myself, like Ryan, deeply attached to a game whose values I recognize within myself, but as a dark part of myself, the dark, angry, unworked out masculine id that is sort of clinging to the prerogatives of being a male who can use sort of violence to try to dominate the world, if not in my life, then at least on my TV screen. And this was a moment where I just realized, wait a second, it's gotten too bad. I love it, too. I know what he's talking about. I miss football right now. I wish I was going with my pals who watch the game. It's a place of refuge for us, a place where we can remove ourselves from the moral complications and disappointments of the adult world. You know, it's refuge. It's a place before the age of reason and before the age of guilt. And it's also an incredibly exciting game. And I played it as a kid, and I spend the first two chapters of the book talking about the incredible intuitive pleasures of playing football, and even the pleasures of running the risk. I mean, I got a couple of dislocated shoulders. I got a concussion playing. It didn't make me want to stop playing. It's what made it important that I was testing myself in some way. So I understand the buzz, and the book is titled Against Football, but it's really about football. It's about why it is so alluring and the psychological and emotional hold that it has over us and what that hold is costing us at the same time. I've certainly heard this line about, you know, football teaches the one thing kids can't get anywhere else, teaches you how to get knocked down and get back up again, and that's all our lives, we're getting knocked down, and, you know, no matter who we are, but football's the thing that teaches you how to get back up again. And I'm like, that is an absurd and degrading myth, ultimately. First off, very few young women play football, and that means they have no hope of developing true grit. But more importantly, Kids face adversity all the time. And Ryan knows this, and your listeners know this, in the classroom, at home, on the playground, within themselves. There's no doubt that sports can help them develop, you know, strength of character and to get back up. But so can a loving parent or a dedicated teacher or an inspiring pastor or a great book. I think football really limits. It's a very narrow way of looking at the world, and that's why when you listen to a football player, the rare exception is somebody who's genuinely self-reflective. And I think sports fans, as a rule, don't want to be self-reflective. It's that idea, blood makes the grass grow. And you go, well, but I don't want to send that message to my kid. I don't want my kid being shouted at. Can't he just enjoy the intuitive pleasures of childhood without feeling that he's got to live up to some macho credo? You know, that's the thing that's remarkable to me is that, and this is the reason that I would, if my son, five-year-old son, wants to go to the park and play football, I would let him. And if he wanted to play tackle, I would let him, because I did that, and even though I got hurt, it would be a hypocrite for me to not allow him to do that. But once they get funneled into this whole system, this whole pipeline, it's a much darker thing, and they're getting a bunch of messages that are all about dulling out their empathy so they can be good at doing a very limited thing. And I think, really, the future of this country resides on everybody becoming more merciful and more empathic.
Let us take another call. Here's Kat in Talent. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Almond. His book is Against Football.
Hi, Jeffrey. Thanks for taking my call. My teenage, well, preteen, actually, he's 12, has started playing football much against my wishes.
Mm-hmm.
And I have tried to explain to him the potential dangers of the concussions and the broken bones, and
right.
He wants to play, loves it. He's a born athlete. He's extremely good at any of the other games that he's played.
Right.
And I don't want him to get into a situation where he damages himself to a point where he cannot play
right.
the other sports. And I want to know what that conversation is. How do I
right.
how do I broach that conversation with him, because he loves it. And
right.
I don't know how to soften that.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for that, Kat. Appreciate it.
Okay, it's a really amazing dilemma that you have. I mean that there's no easy answer. I'm a parent also. There really is nothing that we can do, that is, to make him stop loving football. And even if you push too hard, he's going to push right back against you, because you know as well as I do, you make something off limits or taboo, and that's all they want to get
right.
at. The reality is, though, that there is a lot of really interesting stuff out there that you guys could maybe, now, not just my book, maybe he's not a reader, maybe he doesn't want to read the book, but if you read the book, you would at least start to understand why he's so attached to the game, why it is so important to, you know, boys and men, and also what some of the moral hazards are. And I would recommend also, if he's not a reader, you know, see if you can inveigle him into watching some of the frontline documentaries that talk about the game at the high school level and talk about the real risks of the game. You know, there's lots of stuff that's out there that can, don't think of it as trying to convince him. Think of it as you want to educate yourself, and you feel that you're respectfully asking that he educate himself as well. But you also have to recognize that he might have to learn some of these things himself, as, you know, Ryan's son did, that at a certain point, unless he's given gifts from God or whoever, and he's going to wind up playing at the Division I level, chances are at a certain point he's going to run up against the limits of his own talent. And, you know, we can't as parents say you can do this and you can't do that. All you can do is compassionately say, I have some concerns, and I think you could certainly forbid him from playing. You know, he's a minor. You could do that, but that would probably be disastrous for your relationship. The idea would be to educate yourself and him to the point that maybe he's starting to think about the sport a little bit more broadly. But I do write in the book about a friend of mine who has the same values that Kat does and has a son who loves football. And the dilemma for him as a parent, even though he knew all the risks, was he loves it. It motivates him. It brings him alive. And, you know, that kid is playing in a Division I program in college, and I believe it's a bad parenting decision, but ultimately it's not my decision to make. And, you know, I wouldn't make the same decision, but I would let my kid play tackle football, you know, as a young kid, because you got to allow them to have some risk and some liberty. You cannot protect them from the dangers of the world. But it's a really, really complex question. And just like every fan has to consider whether they feel okay about subsidizing, consuming and subsidizing a game that has the moral corruptions that football does, every parent has to decide how and why, you know, they're going to broach that issue with their kids, because it's a really fun game. I played it enough to know that it's really fun and it's really exciting, and it brings certain kind of kid alive in a way that other things don't. And how do we create the positives and take advantage of the positive part of that without all the negative stuff on top of it and the dangerous stuff?
Here's another call from Dean in Ashland. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Steve Almond, the author of Against Football.
Do you have me online?
Yes. Yeah, Dean, go ahead.
Thank you. Over 60 years ago, when I started high school in the ninth grade, I was kind of a small guy, and I wanted to be a big man on campus, so I went out for football. And I was too slow for the backfield, so they put me on the line.
Yep.
In the second or third scrimmage, I got knocked out, and I said, that's it for me. I'm dumb but not stupid. I'm out of here.
Right.
And I have believed that in football for all these years, and I'm so glad that someone has written a book about it to help all those people out there, those guys that can do something else and not play football and still achieve success.
All right. Thanks for that, Dean.
I'll say one quick thing about that, because one of the things that I find so insidious that sort of ties together my concerns about who I am as a person and a citizen and American and as a parent and what football is, you know, the question is opportunity. The most insidious excuse that we use to sell football is not just that it creates noble virtues and instills these good values and it's exciting and the players are responsible for themselves. We say it's the only way out for a certain kind of kid. And in the coded language, what we really mean is a poor kid from an economically vulnerable community and probably a poor kid of color, probably an African-American kid. What we say to those kids is, listen, we really don't care that much about the content of your character. We really don't care that much about your intellectual development. What we care about is that you're good at entertaining us on a football field. And if you get good enough, your path to economic salvation is through this controlled violence of this game. And I think, and that's not just white America that's saying that, even though we're most of the fans. That's the African-American community. When I was working down in Dade County in Miami, the African-American community viewed football as a form of economic salvation. It was the way that they were going to have some guys get rich and famous. But it's a false dream that we're selling them. The way that we are going to empower young men of color or any kind of young man in this country, especially from an economically vulnerable community, is by creating real equality of opportunity, spending that $250 million that Houston or Baltimore or St. Louis puts into a stadium for something that distracts us from our problems into real schools, teachers, keeping the streets safe, making a better safety net, empowering families. That's really the way that you give those kids a chance, and it's really one of the most insidious and manipulative things that you can say to say, you know what, this class of people and this particular color of people, the only way you're going to succeed is by putting on shoulder pads and a helmet and running into another guy, probably of the same color, for our entertainment. There's something profoundly degrading about that. And it's not just degrading to the players. It's degrading to us, to the national soul.
And you bring up a bunch of health statistics in the book, and one of the key ones here, though, is lifespan. What are we talking about for NFL players and how long they live after they're done?
It's not clear. Honestly, the data is just not clear. The NFL cites one study, oh, well, they live longer, but there's huge problems with that study, and there are researchers who suggest that it's a shorter period of time. They die, their mortality rates are lower than other people. Ultimately, the question is, what's their quality of life? And the reality is that, and this is why, you know, your last caller who got out of football, I know in the moment it must have been difficult for him and he was betraying the brotherhood and being a wimp or whatever else, but in the long term, he made a really, really wise decision. And I say that not because I think football players are miserable, but they really are just trained from a very early age, if they're going to get good, to do one thing and have one way of thinking about the world. It's that blood makes the grass grow outlook on the world. And it is not really concerned with what King would say is the content of their character. Who are they as people? What is their moral system? How capable are they of mercy and of feeling a responsibility for the moral suffering of others and connecting to people through empathy? When you don't have those things, you're not leading a real full life. And part of what I was realizing is that football, for years, has been a place where I've gone to dull out those parts of myself that are painful, but that also make me worth having a life, living an examined life. And that's part of what Against Football is really trying to get at, is it's not just about how long the players live. It's about what kind of life you want to lead. And the idea that being a fan is incredibly exciting and it gains you access to a certain kind of brotherhood. But on the downside of it, it's a way of looking away from your life, not examining your life as deeply and as fully as we're blessed to be able to.
Well, as you said at the beginning, we want to eat the bacon, but we don't want to see the slaughterhouse. And we get to see it in Against Football, One Fan's Reluctant Manifesto. Steve Almond, thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
And thanks for joining us today for the Jefferson Exchange. It airs 8 to 10 a.m. and repeats 8 to 10 p.m. here on the News and Information Service.